WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
Support comes from Gateway Technical College. Become a professionally trained truck driver in just 5 weeks and get job placement assistance. Courses for the Class A CDL license are held in Kenosha year-round. Also upgrade from a B to an A license in just 2 weeks. Visit gtc.edu.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Gateway is offering summer camps for middle school children starting in late June. 12 different classes are being offered, ranging in price from $50 to $400. For full details, visit gtc.edu/summeradventures.
Attention all Facebook users, you're invited to click Like WGTD for breaking news, photos, station program information, links to archives, and to interact with WGTD employees and listeners. The page is available to non-Facebook subscribers as well. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, WGTD Walworth County correspondent Jim McClure, and by Marlo Harmon, a lifelong Racine resident who's currently employed as an addiction counselor at Racine Correctional Institution. And now, here's today's host.
Good morning. This is Len Iaquinta for Community Matters, and our topic today is what's going on in the police department in Kenosha. Particularly, we're celebrating the tenure of Chief John Morrissey and speaking with him about his term as Kenosha's Chief of Police. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
I might mention we're recording this on March 29th in case we miss a news story that happens to break before this is broadcast. You've seen a lot of changes in the department. You've been a member of the department for, what, 27, 28 years?
Yeah, I've been here 27 years, 34 in law enforcement. I started early 1982. In Kenosha, there's been a lot of changes, you know, in all the way from when I was first hired to the, I guess I'll call them the tools that we carried, you know. The guys now have tasers and all kinds of other equipment. But I think more importantly in my 8 years here as the chief, the biggest change is the personnel. So I've hired over 100 officers. Now we have 205 sworn, and we have 18 civilians. So when you look at this, you know, there's good and bad to that. So our force is so young. When you look at the 205 positions and you break them down, about 120 are patrol. So if you figure about 100 of those are hired by me, and the first contact the citizens are going to have is normally the person that's in the squad car. And some of them have a year or less, and the majority of them have 8 years or less. So it's a learning curve there. The pros are they're active, they're willing to work. I think they're into the technology. I know later we're going to talk about probably some things coming up like body cams and things. A lot of the young officers are into that. They like that. They've grown up in this technology age. So there's a lot of good changes. The negatives, of course, are you have those, you know, I'll just say that you got to be kidding me moment. Because they do things that, you know, they're young and they're just learning and the maturity, and some of them, this is their first real job. They're coming out of college. So overall, I'd say that it's many, many more pros than there are cons.
This culture change probably means that there's been a great difference in training that you've seen over this past nearly three decades. You know, tell us a little bit about how training has changed.
Yeah, that's a very good point. When I went through the academy, it was 240 hours. So I had 6 weeks of law enforcement training, and a lot of mine consisted of CPR and range training and a couple of defense and arrest tactics is what we call it now. Now, starting in January, and I served on the Curriculum Advisory Committee for the Law Enforcement Standards Board, it's 720 hours. And we've gone from simply learning how to shoot and fight and do CPR to officer wellness, officer safety, more tools. We teach them, I think, better how to communicate with people. Is there still going to be the physical fight? Sure. You know, but they have so many more different tools, like I said, the taser and the pepper spray and You know, I can't think of the last time one of my officers has hit somebody with a baton. If you'd have asked me back in the early 80s, that was a pretty common tool that we used. So the training is so much different. We focus on the well-being of that officer and how to cope with it, the stress. And as you know, a big part of my tenure as the chief has been suicide prevention in law enforcement and nationwide and some of the committees I serve on. So we've got that into the academy. So the training is so much more focused on the officer and how they conduct themselves both and on and off duty anymore.
Well, de-escalation of conflict has been huge in the news. I'm sure this is not a new topic for professionals like yourself. Could you comment about de-escalation and how that's going to work in the future? It's not always the proper thing to do, but sometimes it may be.
Yeah, I think the bigger issue there is it is a buzzword, and that's what I believe it is. It's a buzzword right now. We're going to de-escalate this. And even back when I started, you know, we've heard the, why can't you shoot the gun out of the hand? Why can't you wound him? Why can't you, you know, that's not realistic. And there is a time and a place for de-escalation. We certainly talk about that. We try to talk them down. But the decisions the men and women in law enforcement, not only here nationwide, make are split-second decisions. Last night, so May 28th, we had an armed subject who had shot into a house, several shots. We found the shell casings by the van. He's locked in the van. He refuses to come out. So my officers have to make split-second decisions of what do you do. So we set up a perimeter. We called in TRT, and the short part of the story is they got him out of the van, ended up tasing him, and everybody's there. That could have ended very differently. He could have pointed a gun out of the window, and shots would have been fired, and probably justifiably. So de-escalation is great. De-escalation is what we want people to do, but I am not going to sit here, and no cop ever is. Those decisions are split-second decisions. And the court years ago, rightfully so in my opinion, made the decision that it's what would a reasonable officer do in that same situation. And that's so important because they are split-second decisions. So de-escalation is great. We try to do that. And as I hire people, one of the things I want to hear them tell me is that they have good communication skills, that they can talk to people. It's important. But let's not forget, most of our calls are very highly escalated. We're responding to violent tendencies already. So it's a great buzzword, but remember, these men and women are making split-second decisions.
Monday morning quarterbacking is popular in sports and certainly in police work, and I don't know of two jobs that I would rather not have than yours or superintendent of schools. I think they're both no-win jobs, personally. I wouldn't even consider one of them. I was amused in going over the history of your work in Kenosha and your appointment some 8 years ago when you, damned if you do, damned if you don't. At one point, you made a statement that you thought it was tragic that someone was shot during an encounter. And the critic writing in the Daily Scoff said that, well, it wasn't tragic at all. A police officer should never say a shooting is tragic. And I thought, my goodness, if someone is shot, you're wrong, and if someone isn't shot, you're wrong. And tragedy covers a lot of things. So some people aren't going to be with the police department no matter whether you do A or B. Nonetheless, there are things that people have been talking about as solutions for perceived problems. And one of those things is the body cam. I wonder if you could tell us where we are in Kenosha with body cams, how you see that fits in nationally, and how important you expect that to be in the future. I'm asking you to gaze in your crystal ball a little bit.
Sure. But let me address the comment, because I've read that comment many times and gave thought to the tragic. And back then and now, I'll say it is tragic. It's tragic not only for that family, and I continue on a yearly basis to get a card and pictures from that young girl who was saved the day that guy was shot. This comment is relative to a case in Walworth County where they ended up shooting him. And they thank me every year for this child being alive. And it's tragic for the officers that had to shoot them. And if you don't think that the officers live with that every day of their life, so back then I disagreed with that guy, today I disagree with the guy, it is tragic. Is it a part of the job? Yes, but it's tragic. So body cams, it's certainly been a discussion, and I'd like to just let everybody know that body cams didn't start in the last 2 or 3 years, and they certainly didn't start because of Ferguson or cases like that. As the IACP, which is the International Association of Chiefs of Police, I've been on the mid-sized cities section. I've been an IACP member for all 8 years, too. But we've discussed this long before Ferguson. And some of the issues that are there continue. And those issues are, and I just want to give you a little synopsis of where this discussion goes at chiefs level, but also at other levels. So I just recently spoke to a criminal justice committee at Parkside 2 weeks ago, and I started out and said, how many of you in here believe that we should have body cams on every cop all the time? And almost every hand in the class went up. I said, okay. So we discussed that, and we discussed, do you want me videotaping you in the hospital? Do you want me videotaping your kids in the schools? Do you want me videotaping you in your house? And what are the rules of who gets to see those videotapes? And by the time that class was done, there were three individuals who still felt maybe body cams were there. Body cams are not the solution by any means. Do they provide guidance? Yes. There's a recent story out of Florida where two firemen accused a sergeant of swearing at them and everything else. The fire chief condemned the cop, came out, showed him the video. The cop was cleared. Both firemen, a captain, and the other guy have been fired. So they are saviors, and I would say 99% of the time, they are always in benefit of the officer. You're probably aware I disciplined an officer for 60 days because it was on video of him using inappropriate force on an individual in Kenosha. So there are pros and cons, but cameras are just that. They do not get 360. They do not get it all. So we've had the discussion when, where, how. All of those questions haven't been asked. So some chiefs have said, well, we have a policy where I will say to you, Mr. Iaquinta, is it okay if I videotape in your house? And you say no. Do I think for 1 minute that the media is going to say police okay because Mr. Iaquinta said no if something goes wrong? Absolutely not. So you can't make foolish policies because foolish policies make us look foolish. So just talking to another police agency, which I won't identify, but they have now decided that an officer cannot have a drink 10 hours before the start of their shift, not even one drink. So if you've had a drink at 9:30 watching a football game and at 3 o'clock the stuff hits the fan, I can't come in. So let's not make foolish policies that make us all look foolish, and that's what happens when you have incidents like that. So the body cam policies are not out there. They're not satisfied yet. There's no court rulings on them. The open records things are huge on who gets to see what. And again, I've named a couple of places, schools, homes, hospitals. Let's answer those questions. Should we be videotaping in there? You know, those are big questions. So if I'm videotaping in the room next to a hospital, we all know you can hear things, and that video gets out, or I'm in your house and your little kid walks by in typical little kid attire in the house, you know, those are questions that aren't answered. So are there pros to them? Yes. Are there cons to them? Yes. There needs to be a lot more court work out. There needs to be decisions. So where we're at in Kenosha is I put $200,000 in the capital improvement budget in 2020. So the money has been allocated. When we get there, I'm not sure. That money could be moved to 2017 very easily by the council. The next chief, of course, will have to decide when and where we go there. Do I believe they're coming? Yes. Do I believe there'll be a mandate to get certain federal grants? Yes. But, you know, the federal grants I get now are $34,000. So the time and effort may not be worth it. So they're coming, I think, but they need to come under the right decisions, not simply because of a couple incidents. And I don't like to break those incidents down statistically, and those incidents, officer-involved shootings, because if you take the billions and billions of calls and the hundreds of those, it becomes such a minute statistic. But to each family, it is a big deal. back to you started this conversation, it is a tragedy when an officer has to shoot somebody for that person, that family, and more specifically, for that officer in that department.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the suicide prevention efforts with respect to officers? And also, of course, you're involved with suicide prevention on the part of citizens, too, when you get calls, and that gets the police involved often. Could you comment a little bit more in detail about how you handle those things and what you see developing?
Yeah, I think we've done a good job. So, as you may know, in 2010, we had two officers within 5 months of each other commit suicide, two active officers. And I, back then or now, wasn't ignorant that it didn't occur. I just didn't think it was a priority. So after the second one, I realized that we each get thrown into things, and it became my priority. So I've served on the National Action Alliance for Suicide Prevention in the Workplace, which covers law enforcement, but it also covers workplace total. Construction workers are one of the second highest suicide things, so we've done a blueprint there. At law enforcement-wise, with the IACP and the Denver Police Department and us, we collaborated. We now have a 12-minute video on how to start the conversation, what to do for officer suicide, officer wellness. There's a facilitation guide, so the Wisconsin Law Enforcement Academies, all 13 of them, this is part of the curriculum now. So one of the down moments of my career is the two officers that committed suicide. One of the highlights of my career are that we have this video, this facilitation guide, as a part of the Law Enforcement Academy in Wisconsin. And I have to give credit to the Carson Spencer Foundation out of Denver and Sally, who has pushed and pushed for this. We've done it on other things. So what we do there is the officer wellness, preparedness, the stress. So we're making headway, not as much as I'd like to on the level. I presented last year at the IACP conference in Chicago. I've presented at the mid-sized cities for the last few years of international chiefs, so we're talking departments between 100,000 in population and a million. So I've become that featured speaker on this. It's a passion that we take care of the cops and their families. And how that translates to local is we've worked with NAMI, the National Association of Mental Illness, and particularly Jack Rose. A majority of our officers are trained in crisis intervention training. So it goes back to the beginning of when you were talking about de-escalation. This is one of those tactics we work on to try and get the officers to learn how to de-escalate the mental health issues and stuff. Suicide is a significant issue. We have, I don't want to say daily, but we have suicides frequently, and I know we're going to talk a little later about drugs and some of the scourge here, but, you know, we had a 19-year-old the other day who the parents thought was clean and went to his bedroom. He's 19. He died of a heroin overdose, and it's a traumatic. It's not a suicide, but it's as close as you're going to get without leaving that note, because we're never going to know. They thought he was clean. How did he get back there? So I, for one, believe you can ask that, and I can ask you or you can ask me, are you thinking about killing yourself? And I didn't put that idea in your head. That is the biggest fallacy that's out there that we need to get rid of, is it is okay to simply ask that question.
My guest this morning on Community Matters is retiring police chief John Morrissey, chief of police in Kenosha. Well, let's loop over to the drug scene. We're between Chicago and Milwaukee. Kenosha, the lovely city by the lake, we like to think has no problems like the big cities do, but those of us who have lived here most of our lives or are native here like I am know differently. What is your take from law enforcement on the drug problem's existence? Particularly, you might comment on what people are calling a heroin epidemic. Journalists like me are always afraid of using words like epidemic improperly. Some people I talk to say it's appropriate use of the word. How bad is it, Chief Morrissey?
I think that the word epidemic fits in the context of heroin. In Kenosha itself, Kenosha County, but even statewide, and now, of course, at a national level, we've focused a lot on that. There have been, as has been reported a couple of major drug busts in the heroin trade. Unfortunately, it is a very cheap drug, and it is a drug that sees no boundaries. So it doesn't matter if you're poor or if you live in a million-dollar home and you bring home a seven-figure salary. I have seen everything, and the 19-year-old young man who just recently died lived in a very nice home and had a very nice family. And there are no boundaries for this. So
it's not somebody else's problem, is what you're saying. It crosses every social class and other demarcation.
Absolutely. This is a problem from top to bottom, left to right. It is an issue because of the cost. It's an issue because it is so addictive, and it's so tough to get off of it. The services, I think, are there to a certain extent if you want to get off. But it's like everything else. Until you hit rock bottom, it's very tough. It's a lot like a person that truly is a gambler that's so far in that you believe that you can dig out and today's going to be my last hit of heroin and today's this and that. And you get to the $100 a day and pretty quick you have nothing left and you're stealing and you're doing everything else. But we've made headway on it. And I think back in 2008, I went back to partner with the sheriff and we did back in the Kenosha Drug Operations Group. So
I remember that there was a news release in December 2008. I kept a copy of it for this interview when the county executive, Jim Cruiser, said that there was a new collaboration between the sheriff's department and the police department to reform the drug task force. I'm glad you brought it up because I was going to ask you, what did that really mean? How did that – what happened?
So when I first started, you talk about the changes. We used to have a collaborative drug unit, and then my predecessor decided that he wanted to go back to focusing more on the city, so we pulled out and we created a street crimes unit where we combined our gang unit and our drug unit, and we had a street crimes unit. And while I think there were good things there, I think there were many things that didn't work. And what I thought we lost was our gang unit is mainly a intelligence gathering unit. That's what their job is. They're to know the players coming in and out, and I think we lost that. So I wanted to go back to making our gang unit be the gang unit they are and always have been, and they are one of the most respected in the state of Wisconsin. They do training for other cities, and I wanted the drug units to focus on drugs because as a street crimes, we became a drug unit. We lost our gang unit part of it, I believe. So I went back. I partnered with the sheriff. We each have three detectives in there. They provide the supervisor. It's called KDOG, Kenosha Drug Operation Group. And I, at this point, would have nothing but praise to say about that group. They work. The majority of their work, of course, is in the city. But what it provides is nobody simply says, oh, you know, if I step on this side of the street, it's Pleasant Prairie. This side's the city. They don't have the boundaries that way either. So this allows my officers to work countywide.
This sort of loops back to a very interesting article that was published in the Police Chief, the Professional Voice of Law Enforcement publication. Back in 2010, I believe, the Crime Prevention Unit, Ron Francis and Jeff Wambolt wrote a nice article about what you're doing in crime prevention. I wonder if you talk a little bit about the success of that operation. And it's always pleasing to hear you say that we are a model for others in the state and that the officers are taking leading roles in developing new programs and publishing in professional journals the results of that work. I think that's really a big plus that I see in a department. What's been going on with that neighborhood and crime prevention program? I wonder if you could summarize how it's worked and what you think it could do in the future for the city.
Sure. And let me just say first, I appreciate your comments on, because I do think that being published in national magazines like the Police Chief and the IACP and having the exposure, again, that I have as the chief for suicide prevention is so important, and most of that never gets out because none of us want to toot our horns that way. But, yes, that's another thing that I started and we got approved was crime prevention officers. So community involvement is the number one crime prevention tactic that we'll always have. Other than physically maybe having a cop standing on every street corner, crime prevention, community involvement. So Ron Francis and Jeff Wambolt started this unit. We've gone from probably 20 neighborhood watches that were active to well in excess of 200. It's kind of become a competition between some of the aldermen, which I love, to see who can get the more neighborhood watches. But that's really what works, and there's so many success stories out there of how that works. So that has to continue. We have this year added a juvenile crime prevention officer. So Felicia's getting into that role, Felicia Labrador, of how does that work. And if we can get into the juvenile individuals, she's doing a lot of presentations in the school. You know, if we start at that level, it's like everything else. The younger you start and the easier you're taught and how you get to where you're going when you get later in life. So we're trying that. Ron and Jeff are still working on that. But we don't just focus on, you know, the neighborhood watch and the sign and the meeting. We focus on senior safety, and we focus on business safety, and we focus on personal safety. There's so many programs that they offer. You know, we offer realtors safety. So if you're a realtor and you want to come, we'll tell you how. Don't be going to these houses at, you know, 10 o'clock at night to meet people you don't know and stuff. And if you are, how to be safe. So there's so many programs there. But we've tried to, I think sometimes when you have specialties, and I don't want to take away from that, you know, my guys in the black and whites, which I'll just make a note of, I'm very proud that we switched our cars back to the black and whites and that we put that to protect and serve on there. To me, that's a symbol, and I think it's a very symbol to be proud of. So, but it's not that the guys in the black and whites aren't crime prevention, but their main focus is to handle the calls, deal with them, and let's move on. Where the crime prevention is not, it's solving, working with that community. And I certainly have bike officers, and we have the motors that will be coming back out in April, and we have the SROs, the school resource officers. We continue to do all of those specialties, which focus on individual things, but the community has to stay involved. The community has to care. One of the jobs, I think, as the chief and the mayor, is you have to tell the people that they're safe. If they're not safe, then they're not there. So you'd kind of mention, those that have lived here. And I wasn't born or raised here, but my kids were born and raised here. My granddaughter's born here. This is our home now. So when I took over, there were 357 violent incidents in 2007, 3,411 property for a total of 3,768 total incidents. So when people talk about the FBI and the UCR numbers, that's the number they talk about. So this year, 2015, so during my 8 years, that number is 283 for violent crimes. That's down 21%. That property index crime is 2,063. That's down 1,348 incidents, 39%.
That's hugely significant.
I believe they're statistics, and they only tell a part of it, but they are significant because in that 8 years, total crime, so we're back to what the FBI says, you know, everybody, that's the big agency in the UCR, 38% during my 8 years. I don't take credit for any of that. That's the men and women on the street, that's the detectives, and that's the community. But it is significant when you realize that our population has grown. Our land mass has grown. You know, we talked about at the beginning of the show what's changed from when I came. I believe Green Bay Road was the west part of the city when I started.
That's right.
Now MB is the west part of the city. We now have land, of course, at 142 in the I across in the town of Paris. That's what's changed. The coverage area. Now, the manpower, I think both the former mayor and the current mayor have done a good job of increasing it. And if you break it down, it really is about two officers per year over that time. And that's what you have to do. What I love to have 20 new policemen every year since I've been the chief. They say to me, Chief, how many more officers do you need? And I say 25. And I'll continue to say that as long as I'm sitting there. I'd like to have 25.
You know what to do with them.
And we could do a lot different. We'd have a traffic unit and we'd do everything else. Len, when I tell you that my phone does not ring because of criminal activity, that's true. My phone rings because we have speeding or we have traffic issues. So while I know there are issues, and there are significant issues, and there are significant issues to the people that are affected there, if my biggest concern and complaints coming into the police chief's office are traffic-related, I think we have a damn good department.
The issue of how the police department relates to the prosecutors in a community is always a topic. And so I'd like to discuss that with you briefly. And now that you're going to disappear from your position, maybe you'll be happy to tell us exactly what you think, or maybe not, because you're staying in town for your granddaughter. And that's wonderful, because you'll be available to be asked to volunteer for lots of wonderful things, and I'm sure that'll be happening very quickly. Where are we on that kind of an issue?
You know, I whether I was leaving or not, I'd be certainly happy to answer that question, and I think the answer is going to be very surprising to your listeners and anybody else. So while I believe we have a good relationship with the district attorney's office, this theory and belief that myself and the DA or my deputy and the deputy DA have this close relationship and that we discuss everything before it is so far from the truth. In the Officer Torres thing, Bob Zaff never once until the very end spoke to me about that. You know, in other incidents, the Kyle Barr incidents, which is probably a black mark on my time as the chief of police, we didn't discuss that. So we have a great relationship with the DA, but it is so far from what people want to make it out, that there's some collusion between the DA's office and the officers. It's so far from there. I'm going to come out and publicly endorse a gentleman running for DA. It doesn't mean that he's going to do things different because I endorse him or whatever. It's a respect for him and his position that I think he can handle that. But the relationship is a very, very professional relationship. There is no friendship between me and the DA's office or the officers, but they have to trust each other. And I trust the DA. The DA has to trust me that we do things. My young officers go to court frequently. The DA has to be able to trust them. They're the ADAs, I should say. They're prosecuting the case, that they know that the officers are competent. We have to know that the ADAs are competent. Perhaps you know this, but, you know, my young officer starts out at $56,000 a year. He's on probation for the first year. A prosecutor who he's leaning on starts at $40-some-thousand a year. So you have somebody with a law degree, probably $100,000 plus of loans, and this young cop who's making 20-some thousand more is asking this person for advice. So, you know, the relationship is a professional relationship. There is no personal relationship between my office and the DA's office, no more than the judges. You know, I think the judges are absolutely fantastic in this county. I don't agree with certain some sentences, but, you know, probably one of the bigger honors I ever had in my life or career as the chief was to speak at Judge Warren's retirement party. I don't think Judge Warren ever provided anything special to us. In fact, what I liked about him was whenever he ruled against my cops, he wrote him a letter and said, this is what you did wrong and you need to change. That's how my guys learn. That's what the relationship is. There is no personal relationship and no collusion there.
Your officers got a nice new contract that was settled at the middle of March or so. I wonder if you just comment from your point of view what that means for the city. It appears from the news reports that it was a pretty amicable agreement and that all sides are happy with the small changes that were made. Is that an accurate description?
Yeah, I think it is. As you may know, I served as the union president many years ago, and the former chief likes to tell me it was some of the most contentious years in history, that during my tenure as the the union president, I filed more grievances than any other union president. I don't know if that's true. I guess it is. But
well, everyone has a role to play in certain situations. The DA has a role. The assistant DAs have a role. You have a role to play. And as union president, it was a different role.
I agree. And but this contract, so my point of saying that was I've been through many contracts that weren't quite so easy. But we have a great relationship with the association. And this contract, because we don't have a lot of issues, it was easy to get there. The biggest things in there, of course, were the wages. So the officers get a 6.5% raise over the next 3 years, 1.5% this year, 2% next year, and then 3%. And what that does wage-wise, it gives some stability to the city. They know where their wages are going. They know where the costs are going to be, so it locks it in that way. Certainly, it also gives the young officers some financial stability. But what I get out of this is, as long as I've been here, there's always been 12 months of sick leave for the officers. But you can abuse that. And I've had in my time as chief 4 times where I've had to either discipline or take a pay step away. So a pay step is about $4,000. That's a pretty significant penalty. But it took you to get there, and it's an abuse issue. So the concessions were we reworded that, and now when you get to 3 years versus 5, if you're an abuser, you have an issue. If you're not, it means absolutely nothing. And I think the vote of 6 no members of the 170 KPPA shows that the membership wants that and appreciates it too. So this gives them stability for 3 years. I don't believe there's going to be any significant changes with my departure under the new chief. As you know, he's coming from within. But there was always that concern, too. If it was out, where does this leave us? So this puts a lot of stability in the KPPA, but it also financially for the city and stuff. So I do think it was one of the easier contracts to resolve.
And I'm sure the new chief is appreciating that.
He is. You know, it's one less thing that's on his plate that he doesn't have to worry about for 3 years.
We've talked about drugs. We haven't really talked about underage drinking, and that was in the news during the winter. License hearings were held because of different kinds of violations. People testified for and against. What's your assessment of the underage drinking issues in our community, and what do you think might be done, if anything, to improve that, perhaps including education on the part of non-police actors as well?
Yeah, this one we probably aren't going to agree on. I don't know that there's much we can do there. I think this comes down to a parental issue of allowing your children to drink or not drink. I have 4 children of my own, 3 boys and a girl. The 2 adopted boys and the 2 biological kids all grew up in different families to begin with, and now, of course, we're just one big family, but you know, we don't have alcohol in the house because that's the way it is. So it's not that they can't drink or don't drink, but this is a family issue of where you decide there. As the chief of police or a law enforcement officer, I will enforce those laws that are on the books. This is one law that I do not agree with and I never have. The drinking age is 21. That's what it legally is. That's what we'll enforce. But I've had a couple of incidents. And maybe this isn't where you wanted me to go, but I really, it's my belief here. We've had many young men and women go to war, and they come back here, and they're 19, they're 20, and they have a drink, and we write them a $200 ticket for underage drinking. Yet, we ask them to go over there, and they've seen horrific things, and we have a lot of our officers that have been in the war. So I have a personal problem with the whole thing. I think you're responsible at 18. You should be allowed to drink at 18. And you suffer the consequences just like anybody else. I understand the reasons why, and I know there's a lot of controversy on my opinion there, but, you know, again, this is what's right and wrong, in my opinion, in the world, and I have an issue when we do that stuff. But so there's nothing we can do, I don't think, education-wise or anything else. It goes back to the house. It goes back to the parents of responsible drinking to your kids. I do appreciate that the council put in the social host. I think that's made a remarkable difference in how things are handled in the city of Kenosha on hosting parties, and that's been a remarkable thing. So, but this issue, in my opinion, is a family issue that needs to be addressed.
Not everything has to be addressed by law enforcement or should.
I couldn't agree with you more.
You're using Facebook now and Twitter as part of your work. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, talking about the changes in our lifetimes and our professional lifetimes? That's certainly one, this kind of instant communication. How's it working out? Has it become frivolous? Has it become useful? Actually, in reporting, some of the best stories are broken through people's tweets these days. You have to attend to Twitter if you're going to be a working journalist, especially in Washington or New York. How's it working out for you?
You know, it's an interesting topic. I personally do not have a Facebook or a Twitter page, and I, at this point in time, do not intend to have a Facebook. But department-wise, it is working out fantastic. We have solved many, many crimes from that Facebook and tips, and we get it out there, but it's also great public relations. It's been gave us the ability to throw things out immediately on road closures and stay away from areas or good stories. So, you know, I agree with you, and as journalist, as you said, I'm sure you have to almost be watching the feed lines coming in instantly of what's going on. But absolutely, for us, it's worked out well. We have 33,000-plus followers on our Facebook page. The majority of it is very positive. We will get the occasional backlash. I've taken the stance that I will allow almost any comments as long as they don't become vulgar or are a personal attack on somebody individually. If people disagree with our things, but it has been, the detectives love it. We frequently will see 2, 3, 4 emails a day saying, you know, please put this person up or this person up for retail thefts or warrants and stuff. So it's got its place in time. I think that it, as a law enforcement, not using it as a tool, it's created a whole new category of crime for us. Identity theft is huge. Threats online are huge. There was a main court case that said threats online, you know, aren't really threats unless there's some act in conjunction. So that way it's been a huge negative for us. It's been a huge creating a lot of work for you guys that specialize in identity theft and just computer crimes and stuff. So so there's pros and cons. The negative, of course, is it has created a lot of threats, and it creates a lot of controversy on the instant stuff that once it's out there and you can't correct it and it doesn't matter. So
are people using Twitter and Facebook to communicate with you in order to remain anonymous or to minimize their identity?
They try. We're not quite there yet. So Crime Stoppers, which is an organization which is not connected to the police department, but we serve as their background, of course, for cases, has just released their Facebook, and they're trying to see if they can handle the anonymity. My concern is, again, that there's no court cases on that. So there have been court cases on Crime Stoppers and anonymity using the phone. We've always been able to protect our identity. So 911 is coming up, and you're going to be it's called Enhanced 911, where you're going to be able to submit stuff through 911 tips and text and things like that. So we're working on that through joint services to get that up and running too. But it's the new technology, and again, it's just something you have to get used to.
If you had one quick piece of advice to give the new mayor, what would you tell him, Chief Morrissey?
Number one part of your job is to make sure that the people believe that they're safe and feel safe in the city, and the police department can't solve all of the problems, and they're not law enforcement problems. You need to revitalize the neighbors, and as a city, we need to work together, and that means the police, the community, the aldermen, the mayor, the different departments, because we are, I believe, a great city, a very safe city, and as we started out, this is really my home now, and it's certainly my kid's home. Don't have any intent of losing that. You're probably aware my son now is on the department. My son-in-law is on the department. So I have a very vested interest not only in the city but in this department. And, you know, as a mayor, your job is to make sure that people believe in the city.
Thank you very much. Our guest this morning has been retiring Police Chief John Morrissey, Chief of the Kenosha Police Department. Good luck to you in the future, and good luck to our listeners. Keep informed and get involved. This is Len Iaquinta for Community Matters. Good day.
You've been listening to Community Matters, a program that airs every Saturday morning at 11:15 on WGTD. For an online recording of today's show,